Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here again with this group. And it's great the way it's continued to be so large, even though it's online and it's really persisted for a long time. So that's, a testament to how much you love the Dharma and to Brigitte's organization and the atmosphere that she creates, so that we all create. So I'm delighted to be here. So tonight's topic is one that is close to my heart, which is simplicity. And I've spent, quite some years choosing to keep my life uncluttered in order to pursue a Dharma path as a layperson. So this idea of simplicity will be kind of the frame for this evening, and we'll explore some things that come out of having simplicity as a value in our life. It's fairly common that when people start to meditate, even if they have a full life with work and family and other things going on, that they begin to realize that simplicity is a value for them. Somehow meditation seems to induce that in people, or people who have that value meditate. I'm not sure which is the cause, but it seems to go together in some way. And I think it has to do with some degree of wisdom that comes in. We see that pursuing wealth or comfort or status for their own sake is less meaningful or satisfying than finding some kind of ease and straightforwardness in our approach to life. And that is about simplicity. So it's probably not a stretch to say that simplicity underlies Dharma practice. Mindfulness itself is inherently simple. We aim to sit quietly and not follow all the pushes and pulls of the mind. Of course, we repeatedly do and get lost in thought, but then we feel immediate ease and I would say simplicity when we return to the present moment and we can just sit again for a little while. Doesn't that feel different when you do that compared to all the complexity that we create? So it's different. So simplicity as a value kind of cuts across the bodily, the verbal, and the mental realms. And without some degree of simplicity in both body and mind, both outer and inner, let's say outer and inner simplicity, I think it's going to be hard to see the more subtle patterns of grasping that we have in our mind, the more underlying things that are driving our way of being in the world. So simplicity is a support for the path also. So, there isn't exactly this framing of simplicity the way I'm saying it in the teachings of the Buddha, maybe because he was often teaching to monks who had already done that. They had already made that choice in their lives. But you can find in sutta, in the suttas, this value expressed so clearly. So I pulled it, for example, out of one of many places I could have chosen, the opening lines of the Metta Sutta. So I'm going to read the Amaravati translation of just the first few verses. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Think some of you know those lines if you know the chant. So these verses, I mean, this is the Metta Sutta. So these verses are linking metta with ethical behavior and with simplicity. Those three kind of go together. And we can see that in our own lives. If we're engaging in an uproar of activities such that we're busy and stressed, that's likely to lead to unwholesome behavior. If we let go of that kind of complication to actively prioritize simplicity in body and speech and mind, then that conduces to a life of care, that supports walking the path, a life of caring for others, of caring for ourselves, of caring for the earth, and of being able to walk the path more straightforwardly. So again, we have simplicity as a support, but I like that it's, you know, explicitly tied to metta, you know, to kindness and goodwill also. So let's just extract a few things from those, you know, simplicity practices from those few lines that I read. So simplicity of body, for example, we have peaceful and calm. So maybe moving more slowly. It doesn't mean that you have to move slow all the time, but, you know, peaceful and calm in the way that we comport our body. Maintaining a balanced posture is in the word upright. And I would say using fewer material resources in the phrase frugal in their ways. So we can extend that a little bit to, you know, not taking more than our share, being simple, being content with little. So once we turn our mind toward this value of simplicity and maybe take it on as a practice, we'll definitely get to notice the ways in which complication has burdened or tangled our relationship with life. So we may find ourselves physically tense or making frantic movements coupled by with inattention to the task that we're doing. Have you ever caught yourself doing that? So then we can see in our, you know, in our body that ease returns immediately when the body and the mind are in the same place. Even if you're moving quickly, if the body and the mind are in the same place, we don't have that feeling of franticness that goes with it. So as I said, simplicity of body doesn't always mean moving slowly or even smoothly. I think there's plenty of room for physical exertion or enjoying active time with children or pets. But we would stay present while we're doing that, you know, mind and body together. And then we'll also notice the complexity of using a lot of resources, whether we're using a lot of paper or water or food packaging or clothing. It's just complicated to have all that stuff. Have to manage it, clean it, deal with it, remember it, take care of it, maintain it, protect it, whatever it is that you need to do. More stuff is more mental energy. So then we have simplicity of speech. We also find that in those verses that I read, some of the phrases. So it directly says straightforward in speech, for example. So speaking straightforwardly with, say, just as many words that are needed. It also says not proud and demanding. So this would be maybe refraining from complaining or demanding in our speech. And then it also literally says gentle in speech and skillful. So speaking words of harmony and kindness, as opposed to words of divisiveness or harshness. So just wise speech in general. Our speech can be rife with complication. You know, the gymnastics that we sometimes go through of trying to influence or convince people of our views or of trying to maintain a certain self-image, very exhausting. Simplicity of speech, I would say, moves toward kind of a baseline of straightforwardness and calmness and gentleness in our speech from which more emotional expressions can come forth. I don't think we're being asked to damp down our emotions or, but they would come forth appropriately and well if we have this baseline of straightforwardness in how we communicate. So that's, again, we feel this ease of verbal simplicity when we have that. And then there's simplicity of mind. So again, turning to the lines I just read, there's the word upright. So we could use that for the body, but also the mind, you know, contentment, honesty, for example. And then it also directly says contentment and humility, and says also wise and skillful. So seeing in wise ways, mentally we can choose to see in ways that are complicated, or we can choose to see in ways that are wise and point toward the simple truths of impermanence and impersonality and other things that are supportive. And then it also has the wonderfully evocative line, unburdened with duties. So I call that choosing non-busyness. So I think it doesn't mean that we have no duties or we have only a few, like let's just sit around like a lump and not have any activities. I don't think it means that at all. I think it means that we're not burdened with our duties, which is a different thing. So we have them. We could even be have a full life of working and other things, but we're not burdened. And I think we probably all know people who somehow have a lot going on, but aren't burdened by it. And we may also know people who have relatively little going on, but they're very burdened by it. And this is a difference in mental attitude, mental simplicity. So I don't think simplifying mental activity is about losing our ability to think things through or to engage in active understanding of things, criticism, say, in a good way, of thing, sophisticated understanding of the world. I don't think that's what simplicity of mental activity is referring to at all. I think about the story of Munindra, who was a an Indian teacher who taught many of the senior Western insight teachers early in their practice when they were going to India. A lot of them studied with him. And one time he was at the market, I think, with some of his students, and he haggled very vigorously with a peanut vendor about the price of a bag of peanuts, kind of aggressively, because you have to do that in Indian markets, that's the culture there. And then when they came back, students said, "Well, how does that fit in with what you teach about being simple, all this, bargaining over a bag of peanuts?" And he said, "You should be simple, but not a simpleton." So I think that's relevant, for our practice. So simplicity, what does simplicity of mind or thought mean? I would say it means clearing away the irrelevant mental activities that obscure clear discernment and flexibility and finding helpful solutions. If we're busy in our mind, we're actually not that effective at finding solutions to things. Probably we could spend less time speculating about the motives and personalities of other people, ruminating about past hurts, planning how to maximize pleasant experiences for ourselves, and pondering our calendar and schedule upcoming. I just think about, mental activity that we might be engaging in because I look at my own mind also. So mental simplicity involves contentment, straightforwardness, and probably some degree of trust in the unfolding of life. So we don't need to be riding it so closely and making this and that happen all the time. And when we do that, when we have that kind of simplicity, it actually frees up energy to do the relevant thinking that supports our life of practice and creates space for the Dharma to unfold. So I think centering our simplicity practice just on these few verses of the Metta Sutta that I read could go very far. It's a good approach to aligning our life more fully with the Dharma. If you look over the Buddhist teachings, there are no encouragements toward becoming more complicated. I couldn't find a single one. So simplicity can accompany us through the complex waters, let's say, of training the mind, like a good friend, a good friend. So I just use the word waters. I found this nice analogy given about crossing a flood, which is kind of an analogy for walking the Dharma path, let's say. So it's a little exchange between a deva and the Buddha. And the deva says, "Tell me, dear sir, how you crossed over the flood." So that means, how did you get free of all the stuff in the mind? And the Buddha says, "I crossed over the flood without pushing forward, without staying in place." And the deva doesn't quite get it and said, but how did you cross over the flood without pushing forward and without staying in place?" And the Buddha says, "When I pushed forward, I was whirled about. And when I stayed in place, I sank. And so I crossed over the flood without pushing forward and without staying in place." So you have to stretch a little bit. You have to be a little intuitive about understanding this. But we see that crossing over is not just about doing nothing staying in place. Simplicity isn't about just canceling your whole calendar and sitting on the couch. It might look simple, but it's not how you get across the flood. We'll sink if we do that. But we can't just push ahead on our own agenda either. Now I'm going to make this happen. Now I'm going to do that. How much more can I pack in? How much more relaxation can I pack into my schedule? I think there's this middle way of sensing how much to go forward and how much to just let the water carry us, I think has something to do with simplicity. There's an uncomplicated way to relate to these waters of life, let's say. So we do have a task to do, getting across the flood, but we have to do it at the right pace. And I wonder if you can feel that in your practice. Can you sense into that? So here's a modern quote that I like a lot. There are several versions of it, and it's let's just say there's several versions of it online. So I couldn't trace the exact source, but I'll just give the version that I like the best, which is this one. It's from Oliver Wendell Holmes. I wouldn't give a fig for the simplicity on this side of complexity, but I would give my life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity. So I think this is similar to crossing this flood. Consider for a moment what that evokes for you. I wouldn't give a fig for the simplicity on this side of complexity, but I would give my life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity. So I think it can be implied in a lot of different ways, but I'm thinking in terms of Dharma practice. And so I think we could say that there's an initial or sort of immediate simplicity to ignorance, to not really knowing what's going on in our mind. So the simplicity, it's pretty simple if you live your life by a lot of assumptions and mental shortcuts, and you just put people in categories and make a lot of general rules about how life should be, and just live that way. It's not very valuable, though. I think a lot of people do that. They kind of have their mental shortcuts and biases and just live within their own structure. But it includes a lot of dukkha because it's not really in line with reality. Simple, but not wise. And so if we're lucky, we get some idea, some understanding that this way of living, where we're not really clear on how things are, is not helpful. And that the solution to that is to train the mind, is to enter the water and try to get across the flood. We have to actually do that. So training the mind is going to be helpful in some way. So then we enter into the complexity of the body and the mind. We have to engage with our stuff. But if we do so with mindfulness, we're beginning to untangle the knots that we find in our body, that we find in our mind, that we find in our psyche, in our heart. And we have to really engage with our stuff at some level, but with the tools of the Dharma, with the tools of mindfulness, of wise understanding, of care, of heart qualities, the things that help us to actually untangle those knots that we find and not just keep getting caught in them again and again. So if we do that, then eventually we start seeing some greater simplicity again. Essentially, the mind starts to settle down, get some tranquility, maybe get some concentration. Then we find that we're in a place that's more inward and it is simpler. But that's not the end. Achieving that kind of inner simplicity of being able to sit with tranquility, then we can move into the even deeper simplicity of wisdom and insight. So the psychological realm is useful, but it can't end all of suffering. So with wisdom, we see, for example, that it's really just about suffering and the end of suffering. It's about clinging and letting go and all the particular manifestations of dukkha that we have in our own life, because we all have our unique blend of dukkha in various ways. But all of that is part of this universal phenomenon of dukkha that all humans are experiencing in their hearts. And so when we see that, it actually starts to become simpler again. Our stuff isn't just our terrible story and all the burdens and the bad things that happen to me and the people and all the stuff I have to work through. It's part of this big picture of the dukkha of having a human heart. And we have the simplicity again of how we can apply the wisdom teachings. We have a roadmap essentially, and our stuff is just part of the big stuff, and everything we can do to alleviate it is helping not only ourselves but others. So we see that, this particular dukkha in our life is of a piece with this universal phenomenon for humans. And so then it gets simple again. And then it's yet one more step, maybe. We have multiple layers of simplicity, but it's one more step to live a life of wisdom. So we get the understanding, oh, I get it. I get the thing about what the Buddha was saying. And then we have to manifest that and actually have a simple life of wisdom characterized by straightforwardness, non-manipulation, non-complication, alignment of our outer and inner lives, and this value of simplicity that cuts through all of it. That takes real practice and maybe decades to do that. But if that's the simplicity on the other side of complexity, and then, maybe in the very end, freedom. The freedom that the Buddha was pointing to is the simplest of all. So I want to read from T.S. Eliot, Little Gidding. Not known because not looked for, but heard, half heard in the stillness between two waves of the sea. Quick now, here, now, always, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. And all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. It's quite beautiful what he points to. So how do we get there, of course? How do we get there? So the way to find that deeper simplicity on the other shore is to stay with simplicity all along the path. We're always looking for that dynamic balance of not pushing forward, not standing still. And I think this balance changes over time. Sometimes we're more active, really cultivating something or focusing on a certain area of practice, or we get really excited about some particular teaching, and then we sort of immerse ourselves in it. And other times, it doesn't feel so focused, but we continue with mindfulness and we stay open and see what happens. And it's more like that, more of the standing still, letting the water flow. Always, it's just being present in a simple way with either activity or something slower and more restful. Either way, we just stay with it, simple mindfulness, go with that. It's a very healthy approach to practice. In the end, the path is one of letting go. I recently looked up various Pali words for letting go. There are a lot. I don't know if it's an urban myth or not, this thing about the Eskimos having a lot of words for snow, but Buddhism has a lot of words for letting go, it turns out. That's what's important there. So we're not going to go through all of them, don't worry, but I just want to give a flavor of the range of what they mean. So some words for letting go actually mean something like generosity or giving. Those words are in the letting go category. That's the most basic form of letting go, and it's the foundation of the path. Generosity almost always comes first in lists, and it's the first topic the Buddha would teach to people. Let go of something and give it to someone else. That's very basic. And then there's maybe material renunciation, or we could just call it lightening up in our own life, having less stuff, getting simpler in where you live, how much you use. So nice, so relaxing for the mind, so beautiful. Sometimes we feel resistance, not just because we want to grab onto our stuff and hold it. We don't necessarily need it, but oh, it's going to be such a pain to try to clean out the garage. Gosh, we never get to it. But if you do, there's so much joy waiting for you. Whenever I've talked with people who really got around finally to cleaning that closet, they're so happy. Yeah, just letting go of all that, so much lighter. Even though they weren't using all the stuff in the closet, it just takes up mental space somehow. So it's also nice to know that material renunciation is not what we think. It's not at all about austerity. Austerity, if you look at the way it's used in the Buddhist teachings, it's associated with wisdom, joy, ethical conduct, and energy and faith. So all of those are words that are directly associated with the word for renunciation, quote unquote. Let's just call it letting go. So this is a very, very beneficial and positive thing. And then after, you know, the generosity and the material renunciation, we have letting go of mental patterns. So letting go of all of our habits of carrying grudges and judging things and being irritated and being sad and being envious and being graspy and all these things that, you know, we know are patterns, right? And then there's, you know, there's a process of letting go of those, and that's also part of the practice. And then eventually we let go of identity and the really deep patterns in the mind, you know, the sense of being me and being, not that you're going to become nothing, but, you know, the sense of having to be something in particular or having to fulfill a role or do certain tasks and requirements in order to fulfill, I don't know, some abstract idea. You can just be free to be an expression of wisdom and love in the world. That's letting go of identity. And simplicity lies at the basis for being able to let go. We start to see that holding on is actually something that creates complexity and strain, whereas simplicity is open and easeful. And it takes a while, but we slowly get convinced of this at a deeper and deeper level, I would say. So there's trust. Trust in the unfolding of life is part of simplicity. And creating a space so that the Dharma can come through, can be expressed through us. So then I guess we're back to the Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. It's quite simple, actually, if we let it happen. So these are my thoughts for this evening on simplicity, and pretty simple, I hope, and I'll just see what you might have to contribute or ask.